Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents What We Did in the War by Jenny Walters, narrated by Henrietta Meir. Prologue. High Wycombe, November 1952. I found her at last, my partner in crime. It's taken 8 years, but finally I've tracked her down. She's standing with her back to me, looking out at the window. Her cardigan slung around her shoulders and she holds a cigarette aloft, one hand cupping her elbow, and a thin plume of smoke spiralling up into the air. I close the door behind me, suddenly lightheaded, and dig my fingernails into my palms. She turns around, smiles, and advances towards me with her hand outstretched. Hello, you must be. She stops when she realizes who it really is, the color draining from her face. Good God, she says, taking a step back. Heavens! I put on a smile, pretending just in time to act surprised too. Claude, can it really be you? God, what an extraordinary coincidence! She stands there, staring at me dumbfounded. At least I have the chance to take a good look at her, see how she's changed in the time we've been apart. She's become, well, dowdy, that's the only word for it. Her face has filled out, her hair has been tightly and unflatteringly permed, and she's wearing a lumpy tweed skirt and sludge-coloured twinset with pearls, of course. Pearls are part of the uniform, although I sold mine long ago and haven't the heart or the money to replace them. I used to think she could wear anything and look marvellous, but now all that panache has gone. Torn between disappointment and relief, I wonder for a moment how this unremarkable figure can have lived inside my head for so long. Then I catch in her eyes a glimpse of the glorious creature she once was, and remember what she did to me. And I'm glad she looks a frump. Glad I'm perfectly made up and wearing a particularly smart costume in black and white houndstooth check. Glad she looks afraid. You'll never be pretty, but you can try to be chic, she said to me once. And I've taken her words to heart. You look well, I say, since that's the sort of remark people generally make in these situations. She doesn't return the compliment, although I deserve it more than she does. Instead, she says, I wondered whether I'd ever see you again, and gives me an odd little smile, her eyes rather glassy and strange. Her accent is more cultivated than it used to be, and I wonder whether she's putting it on for my benefit, or whether this is how she talks nowadays. We don't seem to be getting very far. I prop my briefcase against a chair and push up my sleeves in a businesslike fashion so that my bracelets jangle. Well, you have a beautiful home. Have you decided which rooms you'd like to refurbish? I usually say something similar to clients, but in this case it happens to be true. Her house is charming, a large Edwardian villa with high ceilings and tall arched windows filling the rooms with light. The garden's lovely too, from what I can see through the window, with stone steps from the terrace leading down to a sweeping lawn and a parterre formed of clipped box hedges. She laughs uncertainly. Do you seriously think we're going to sit down and discuss soft furnishings? Why not? The company offered a free design consultation. You might as well have it. She stubs out her cigarette, walks over to the sideboard and pours herself a whiskey from a cut glass decanter. Pressing the glass against her cheek for a moment, she says, So, you work at Berridge's. That's quite a step up. I'd say we've both done rather well for ourselves. Clever old you, marrying into money. I won't be patronised by anyone, least of all her. She hasn't even had the decency to offer me a drink. She flushes. This is all rather awkward. I'd like you to leave, if you don't mind. Obviously, I shan't be asking you to do any work in my home. She's becoming more sure of herself, but I don't appreciate being dismissed like an unsatisfactory servant. Don't you think we should talk? No, I do not. She takes a mouthful of scotch, clutching the glass so tightly her knuckles turn white. What on earth is there to say? I want to explain. You owe me that, at least. I sit down in the chair beside my briefcase and light a cigarette to show her I'm not going anywhere. She'll have to account for herself, too, though I know better than to say so. I don't owe you anything, she tells me. Really? Do you honestly imagine you'd be living in a house like this, were it not for me? I wave a hand around the room to take in the cut glass chandelier, the antique furniture, the surprisingly good paintings. I bet your husband has no idea what we got up to during the war. She opens her mouth and shuts it again, the colour rising in her cheeks. And then, right on cue, the door opens and the man himself walks in. He's tall and distinguished in a sports jacket and flannels, greying at the temples. In his early 40s, I'd guess, a good 10 years older than Claude. Hello there, he says, amiably enough. Sorry to interrupt. And then to her, Stella, darling, have you seen my specs? Can't find the damn things anywhere. Without a word, she picks up a pair of spectacles from a side table and hands them to him. Thanks, he says, glancing at the two of us. Everything all right? Of course. She smiles automatically, coming back to herself. Henry, this is... She hesitates, no doubt wondering which name I go by these days. I stand up, reaching out my hand. Margot Hall, how do you do? From the interior designers, she adds. Do you remember? I mentioned someone was coming this morning. So you did. Henry Lysett, he says, shaking my hand. Well, I'll leave you to your deliberations. Women's work. Not sure I can add anything to the proceedings. He helps himself to a sherry and wanders off, leaving the door ajar. Alone again, we face each other. This isn't a coincidence, is it? She says. Somehow you've managed to find me. Well, no one can stay hidden forever. You of all people should know that. So what do you want? I told you. I want to explain. Nothing more. She glances towards the open door. Someone is clattering pots and pans in the kitchen. The housekeeper who showed me in, probably. And her husband can't be far away. We can't talk here. Let's go out to the garden. Round one to me, I think. 1. How it all began. London, July 1944. I shall always remember the first time I saw her, downstairs at La Petite Amie. I only have to close my eyes and I'm back in that hushed, subterranean room, listening to snatches of other people's conversation, punctuated by the creaking wheels of the dessert trolley with its solitary bowl of trifle, and the occasional blare of a siren. She and her companion, a blustering colonel with red pips on his shoulder, were sitting at the table to my right, and she was facing me. So it was hard not to catch her eye whenever I glanced around. The restaurant was only half full, and I felt a little self-conscious, eating alone. Yet I wasn't the sort of person who attracted attention, not then. And that day I was as nondescript as usual, in my tweed skirt, twin set, and pearls. They were rather good pearls, but it always seemed to me they lost some of their lustre as soon as I fastened them around my neck. The most one could say was that I looked respectable, which was the impression I wanted to give. Anyway, taking too much trouble over one's appearance was frowned upon then. We were meant to have our minds on higher things, like making Walton pie and winning the war. This girl was my opposite in every respect. Somehow she managed to make her drab khaki uniform seem glamorous, as though it had been tailored to fit so perfectly. She had a full, old-fashioned sort of figure with an ample bust. Her hair was a vivid reddish-brown, the colour of a conker, scooped into an untidy knot with strands escaping over her collar. And she had a freckled, tawny complexion with lively hazel eyes. She threw her hands about when she spoke, in a piercing, rather affected voice, and her face was extravagantly mobile. Anyone could tell what she was thinking. She was a few years younger than me, I guessed. In her mid-twenties, maybe? She was probably his driver. In other circumstances, I might have amused myself by making up a story about this odd couple embarking on an affair. But I was too distracted that day to let my imagination run riot. The colonel had a fat, bristly neck that bulged over his collar, and he slurped up his soup like a pig at the trough. He was making a great performance out of eating, breaking a roll into pieces and pushing them around the bowl with his spoon like a tiny bread flotilla while he held forth on various topics. He was declaiming about morale among the other ranks, and when this girl winked at me over his lowered head, then rolled her eyes with such a wicked expression that I snorted with laughter and had to snatch up a napkin to cover my mouth. My pretend coughing fit soon turned into a real one, which made the colonel turn to glare at me. I daren't look their way again, and spent the next 10 minutes turning over the empty pages of my engagement diary in an effort to compose myself. I ordered a glass of red wine from the waiter when he brought my pâté. Under the navy cardigan, my heart was beating fast. It had taken some courage and careful preparation to come to London in that doodle-bug summer of 1944, when the Germans were blowing the city to pieces. We were only meant to travel if our journey was strictly necessary, although the trains were already much less crowded than they had been in the spring, when the whole country seemed to have been on the move. Now that our troops were beating back the enemy in France, those petty restrictions were easing a little, so I'd taken an uncharacteristic risk and booked my ticket. The solicitor's letter had requested my presence in person, and frankly any chance of a break from the utter dreariness of my life at the time was worth seizing. I debated for ages over what excuse to make at the farm. In the end, I muttered something about having to see a specialist in London, blushing so furiously that the manager must have assumed it was something to do with women's problems. He let me have the day off, grudgingly, on condition that I did the morning's milking first. I'd been in the land army for a couple of years by then, up at dawn to herd the cows, and home after a long day's work to give mother her supper and help her to bed, and a week each summer was the only holiday I'd taken. I told mother I'd been summoned to the city on land army business, and that Ellen would stay to serve her supper in case I was late home. I could tell what she thought about my outing from the way she stood in the kitchen doorway the night before, leaning on her walking frame to glare at me while I laid up the lunch tray. Bread and margarine with the crusts off, a slice of cheese and a hard-boiled egg. Yes, a shell egg. I'd been hoarding it for days. She clearly didn't believe my story about a training lecture for tractor drivers, though, of course, she didn't say a word. The nurse had said her speech might improve with practice, but she hadn't tried to talk since the stroke. She used to write me shaky notes instead. Fetch commode, shut window, leg hurt.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?